It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I am Tony Vernetti and I'm pleased to be filling in for the attorneys over at Shaw, Bransford, and Roth, who normally host a show. And we have an exciting show for you today that we're going to do actually in two parts. First, we will have Dexter Brooks and JoLynda Johnson from the EEOC's Office of Federal Operations. And we'll be talking to them about the EEOC's upcoming Executive Leadership Conference that's coming up this May in Cambridge, Maryland. Good morning, Dexter and JoLynda, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Tony. Thanks.
And just so our listeners know, for the second half of the show, I will have in studio Doug Gentile from the Association of Federal External Civil Rights Specialists and Officers to talk about the important work his association is involved in and the programs, the federal external civil rights programs that they support. Just a reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on GEICO, go to geico.com. If you would like to join our discussion or you have a question for one of our guests, you can call in at 877-936-9333, or you can always send us an email at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Dexter, let's start by introducing for our listeners the EEOC and the Office of Federal Operations.
Sure, Tony. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is an independent agency in the executive branch of the federal government. Our primary responsibility is to stop and remedy employment discrimination throughout the country, whether it be private, state, or a federal employer. The EEOC has field offices throughout the country. We have 53 offices located throughout the country to receive charges of discrimination, to conduct mediation. In the private sector, when an individual feels that their company or their state employer has discriminated against them because of one of the protected bases that we cover at EEOC, which is race, color, national origin, gender, religion, disability, age, and retaliation, and then genetic information, which is one of our newer statutes, they can seek protection from EEOC. They would come in and start the charge process, which most likely would start with mediation and potentially end with conciliation. And so we have a very strong and robust intake, investigation, and mediation program for private and state employers. In the federal sector, we have a different process, whereas we don't initiate a charge process with EEOC. The federal government, when the laws were passed, was intended to be the model employer. So as the model employer, the federal government is charged with trying to remedy discrimination before it gets to EEOC. So we oversee a complaint process that begins within a federal agency. So each agency is required by law to have an internal EEO program. And it starts with what we call informal counseling to try to resolve the complaint, which includes mediation and alternate dispute resolution programs. Then the person can potentially file a complaint and have it investigated. They can then request a hearing before EEOC, and then the commission itself serves as the final appellate body through the Office of Federal Operation. And we do that on our complaint side. But EEOC's mission is broader than just litigation. We are required by statute to try to prevent employment discrimination through education and outreach and oversight. And in the federal sector, we have a unique oversight role. So through the Office of Federal Operation, we actually conduct oversight of agencies. We collect data. We try to find best practices. We sometimes will audit agencies and try to give them recommendations for approval. We have a strong and robust training and outreach program where we try to get information out there proactively to federal agencies so they can make better decisions and not have to deal with the EEOC in the complaints arena. And so in the Office of Federal Operations, we're kind of set up that way. We have our pellet program that deals with complaints of discrimination that arise from the federal sector. And then we also have our federal sector programs that does oversight, guidance, training, and outreach to the federal community.
You mentioned, Dexter, you mentioned best practices and the OFO, Office of Federal Operations, and its role and responsibilities in outreach and really trying, really promoting and encouraging professionalism in the federal EEO community. And I think that's a great segue to move into the talk about the executive leadership conference, which is what we want to spend the bulk of our time on today. And I should mention that Dexter is the director of federal sector programs, and Jolinda is the director of federal training and outreach within OFO. Jolinda, let's talk about the executive leadership conference. It's a relatively new concept for OFO. This is the second year that you are having it. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the purpose, the reasons, the focus of it.
Sure. The ELC, the Executive Leadership Conference, came about as a result of feedback that the EEOC and specifically OFO has received over the years from our stakeholders. EEOC puts on a couple of conferences every year. We put on a conference on the state and local side, and we also put on a conference on the federal side called the Excel Conference. And it's our largest training conference and the largest opportunity to train the biggest group of people you can at one time on all topics EEO related and all the things that we need federal employers to know and to practice and to do in order to be model employers. But some of the feedback we got from more senior EEO officials and attorneys who practice in this area and HR officials who are involved in the EEO arena was that the Excel Conference met the needs of their beginning career staff and their mid-level career staff, but it didn't necessarily meet the needs of their executives. And we certainly take all comments that we receive from stakeholders to heart, and we thought long and hard about what we could do about it. And what came out of those discussions was the Executive Leadership Conference. And this is our effort to meet those executive training level, executive training needs of EEO executives, HR executives, all those who practice in the human capital area and ensuring that employment discrimination doesn't occur in your agency, ensuring that your agency is a model employer. And so we put together what I think is a fantastic conference. It's a three-day conference that's going to happen in May, as you mentioned at the top of the show. It's May 15th through the 17th, and the focus is on how can you be a better leader. And every class is really designed with that question in mind. What can we do to improve your leadership skills in a variety of areas? And we have a lot of exciting topics. We have a lot of exciting presenters, and I think it's going to be a great conference.
And that's a good point to emphasize, Jolinda. You mentioned Excel and some of the other training conferences and outreach that your offices are involved with that deal primarily with the substantive EEO arena, the substantive law. This conference is more about professional development needs, dealing with those core competencies that EEO executives need to learn to be able, you know, to lead, you know, to lead their organization and lead it very effectively, and to also be a leader, you know, throughout their agency, you know, as they're promoting and communicating these very important programs. I just wonder if you could spend a little time telling our listeners, somebody who's thinking about coming, why it's important as an EEO executive and leader that you should want to engage in this kind of professional development.
Okay, sure. I'd be happy to. I think from our perspective, it's exactly what you said, which is it's important to be a successful leader within your agency in order to have a successful EEO program, in order to have a successful agency, a model agency, both under the standards that are promoted by EEOC under our Management Directive 715 and the general mandate for the federal government to be a model employer. In order to meet those challenges, EEO professionals, HR professionals, anyone who works in this area, they have to be within themselves and within their program equipped leaders. And that means having the requisite leadership skills. And certainly, I think a lot of EEO professionals come to the table with a great deal of knowledge about civil rights history, about employment discrimination law. There are certainly a lot of attorneys that practice in the area who are very technically sound, but they maybe don't have some of the leadership skills that are necessary to really grow their program and lead their program to where we would like to see it at a model program, a model program status and a model employer status. That requires skills that are not necessarily taught in college, not necessarily taught in law school. It requires an exploration of your leadership style. It requires an understanding of the impact of your leadership style on your workforce and whether or not that's an impact that you want to have. And if you want to make changes, how do you go about doing that? Speaking of change, often, as a result of things that come up in the EEO process, change must occur in an agency. How do you lead change? How do you instill that? How do you have that embraced by your workforce and make it a successful event? Those things have to happen in agencies on a regular basis, but individuals are not necessarily equipped with that. And so I think this type of conference is the perfect venue to explore the leadership skills that you need to be successful.
Right. And I'll give this, I'll give the website out early and often here so people can take a look and get on there and hopefully register through our website. It's www.EEOCLeadershipConference.com. That's EEOCLeadershipConference.com. Or you can call our office at 202-331-0004 and someone can assist you in getting registered. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm here with Dexter Brooks and Jolinda Johnson from the EEOC's Office of Federal Operations, and we're talking about their upcoming Executive Leadership Conference. We'll continue our discussion after this break and a word from our sponsor.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I am Tony Vernetti, and I'm talking with Dexter Brooks and Jolinda Johnson from the EEOC's Office of Federal Operations about their upcoming conference, the Executive Leadership Conference in Cambridge, Maryland, May 15th through the 17th. If you have a question for one of our guests, you can email a question in. If you have a question about the conference, you can send it to FedTalk@federalnewsradio.com. Dexter or Jolinda, I wonder if you could just give some of the main conference highlights, some of the key speakers that we've lined up.
I'll let you take it, Dexter.
Oh, sure. We have a variety of workshops, so if you really want to get the detailed information, we suggest that you go to the website that Tony gave you, which is www.eeocleadershipconference.com, and you can get more information. But some of the highlights are we will have the EEOC chair, Jacqueline Berrien, who will open the conference and give welcome and purpose to why we're here and what we're trying to accomplish in achieving more effective organizational leaders. We're going to have a keynote address by former Labor Secretary Alexis Herman, who can provide a meaningful perspective of a political appointee and her expectation when she was Secretary of Labor and in other positions through her career, what made an effective EEO manager, HR manager, in terms of facilitating organizational change.
Actually, the first African-American Labor Secretary as well.
That is true. And then we have some great workshops that's very focused on some of the things that Joe Linda outlined in terms of the technical competencies that we want to instill in EEO HR leaders, such as being effective change agents and things of that nature. We're going to have a panel of SES members who lead EEO programs at large federal agencies to talk about their journey and how they made it to their level and then some of the challenges you should expect once you make it to the senior levels of these types of programs. We're going to have great speakers from Franklin Covey, the Federal Executive Institute, OPM's premier executive training institute on different management and leadership principles. And then we're going to have a host of other presenters throughout the government to provide the type of technical training that we believe will help these individuals grow within their careers.
Yeah, I want to ask Jo Linda here in a second just to talk a little bit more about the segment we're going to have from Franklin Covey. But Dexter, I know one of the panels and some of the courses we lined up having to do with the SES, getting into the SES, what that means. I know that was something that was very important to you. Can you expand upon that a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, I know that at the highest level of some of these agencies, the positions are at the SES level, and there's some unique things that folks need to be prepared. If they want a career path that leads to the SES, you start building it early on in your career. So as this conference targets GS-14s and 15s who are emerging and SES leaders who want to enhance some of their skills, we're trying to give them platforms so they can set a new course for their career. So we will have sessions on the ECQs, which is the executive qualifications that are necessary to be a member of the senior executive service. And like I said before, we'll have the a host of senior executive members there to provide some guidance to individuals who have that career aspiration.
I think in addition to that, if I could just add, is we do certainly have these classes both for those who are currently in the SES as well as those who are trying to rise to the level of SES, but we also have some more informal opportunities for individuals who attend the conference to network with each other and learn from each other. We have designed the conference so that you can get the most out of it professionally and personally as possible, including setting aside time for a specific networking event so that you can talk to your colleagues and agencies who may have successfully addressed problems that you were currently dealing with in your agency and try to figure out how they've addressed those problems and what you can do differently. Or on a more personal level, how did you rise to the level that you're currently at and what can I do in my career to get there? So I think there are classes, but there are also these informal opportunities. And it's in a setting, I think, that promotes that kind of thoughtful discussion.
And Joe, I think that's a great point. And that's what I think really what the conference is all about. It's a, you know, executive. You're so busy day to day, you know, you're running from meeting to meeting, you know, you're dealing with, you know, complaints, you're dealing, you know, with all these issues, that the conference is really a time to sort of, you know, slow down, take a break, take stock in what you're doing, you know, professionally, you know, relax. We're going to have some relaxing in there, you know, communicate with your peers and colleagues at other agencies, you know, and you know, really self-assessed, you know, where you're at professionally, what you can learn, and where you can go from here. I know Dexter said a list of the workshops are on the website at EEOC Leadership Conference.com, but just briefly, I want to run through some of them so our listeners can get a little bit of a flavor for what I'm talking about. Like, we've got a course called Emotions, Energy, and Leadership. I've got Successful Leading Organizational Change, Trust Building, Cultural Leadership, NeuroFed, Leading with the Brain and Mind, Leadership at the Top, Leading Across Generations, Successful Leading Organizational Change, Executive Negotiation. So you can see there's a lot of, you know, dynamic courses there, and we've got a lot of dynamic presenters. We mentioned Federal Executive Institute's going to be involved, George Washington University, Management Concepts have all given us instructors, and Franklin Covey is one, Jolinda, I know, is important to you, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the course that they're going to provide on the four imperatives of a great leader.
Sure. It is, I think, important. Franklin Covey, I think most people have probably heard the name of the company, but maybe just associate that name with the time management planners that they offer. But for those who don't know, on the Franklin Covey actually has two sides. They have the time management side, but they also have a leadership and development side, and they have developed quite an expertise in the area of leadership, in the areas that impact leadership and what it means to be successful and what helps individuals be successful and what more importantly prevents individuals from being successful. And as a result, they have quite a dynamic catalog of courses that they offer. And we've had the opportunity through Federal Training and Outreach to participate in a couple of them and found them very valuable. And it was exactly the type of training that we thought would be unique and important for this type of training conference. So they're actually going to offer two sessions. One of them is a plenary called The Four Imperatives of a Great Leader, and it's a plenary because it's something that everyone who attends the conference really needs to embrace. I think they're going to get a lot out of it, and then they're also conducting a workshop for us on generational leadership, and given this time in our current workforce, we have in some agencies three generations,
right,
and others four generations working together, and those four generations often work very differently and see the world very differently, and that those differences can lead to conflict, and I think the tools that people will walk away from that session with will be invaluable in addressing some of those conflicts.
Right. And in the about 3 minutes that we have left, I'd like to talk a little bit about an added segment this year that we're going to have. We're excited to add on to the conference is the Women's Forum. I know we're going to be able, there's a much anticipated report being released from the EEOC on women and African Americans in the federal workforce. We're actually going to use this conference to release the report and then afterwards have a women's forum, a panel discussion about women's issue in the federal workforce. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Over the last, I would say 2 years, Dexter, is that accurate?
Yeah.
18 months to 2 years. We had a work group internally, internal to OFO, who reached out to many, many different stakeholders, and not necessarily our traditional stakeholders, but new and different stakeholders, to talk about the issues facing African Americans and women in the workplace. And to find out what our stakeholders thought about that, to find out what these academic groups thought about that, get their impressions, get their thoughts, get their recommendations. The work group spent a lot of time and energy collecting a lot of good information from those groups, roughly about 18 months. And so what our intent is for the conference is to talk about exactly what that process was and what we learned from those stakeholders. We haven't necessarily validated any of the ideas that were put forth from the stakeholders in terms of, yes, we agree that is a problem, yes, we agree that is a barrier, but they certainly gave us a lot to work with. And so at the ELC, what we hope to do is we're going to present all the information that was gathered from these work groups, and then we're going to follow that up with what I expect to be a very robust discussion on some of the issues facing women in the workplace and how we can address them as a community.
And we're gonna end the conference with that, right?
We are. We're going to end it on a high note, I think. It's going to leave everyone with some great action items going forward.
So if you're just joining us, I want to quickly just tell our leaders, just reemphasize what the Executive Leadership Conference is all about. It's designed for senior EEO officials from federal, state, and local governments, EEO executives in the private sector, those who seek to move into really more senior positions, even HR executives who have significant responsibilities in managing and implementing EEO programs, all are encouraged to attend. Again, the dates are May 15th to May 17th. It's you can get more information at EEOCleadershipconference.com. It's in Cambridge, Maryland. I know there's a lot of restrictions right now in the federal government on travel. You know, I would tell your folks this is relatively local travel. So I hope you can find some room in a budget, because it's a really exciting conference, and I think you would really, really enjoy it. We have to stop here for our second break, and unfortunately, we're going to have to say goodbye to Jolinda and Dexter. Jolinda and Dexter, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Tony. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
When we come back, I will be joined by Doug Gentile from the Association of Federal External Civil Rights Specialists and Officers. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
I'm Bill Bransford, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Fed Talk brings you inside information on hot topics in the federal community. From the halls of Congress to federal agencies, get the latest on the laws, regulations, and activities that directly impact federal employees. Tune into Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM as we bring in the experts to bring you inside the issues.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Tony Vernetti, and I'd like to introduce to you Doug Gentile from the Association of Federal External Civil Rights Specialists and Officers, who is in studio with me. Good morning, Doug, and welcome to the show.
Good morning, Tony. Thanks for having us on. As Tony said, our group is the Association of Federal External Civil Rights Specialists and Officers. We don't have an acronym. People in the community just call us the Association. And our mission is to promote the best practices and visibility of civil rights programs impacting public access to federal government programs and federally funded programs. We represent the public access civil rights officers and specialists all across the United States. And we basically advise other federal agencies. Now, we're an interagency group. We're not a separate group. You know, we have no independent funding. We operate under the sponsorship of these agencies, and they provide money, things for like sign language interpreters and space. And we bring in guests once a month for forum, and we discuss the hot topics in public civil rights. And we use these forums as an opportunity to train our new practitioners. I just want to give a tribute to our association chair, Leslie Leitner, and association co-chair, Lydia Ponte Morales. And without their strong leadership, we would not even have this association. And they're on travel, so they asked me to go ahead and fill in. So consider me just a pinch hitter.
Doug, if you could, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about where you work, your agency, and your background?
Okay, I'm the Civil Rights Coordinator for Public Access for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So I do all the public access, you know, for that agency. And just a little plug, you know, they are the number one environmental conservation organization in the USA. It's a great place to work. And Fish and Wildlife Service, which is part of DOI, they're both very supportive of public civil rights.
And you've been doing this for quite some time. I remember before the show, you were joking before I was born, but not quite.
I can't even remember when I started this, but I just wanted to, again, thank you and for the opportunity to follow Joe Linda and Dexter, you know, who, you know, are great advocates. And that's a great segue, you know, I think, for us to highlight the difference between what our program is and what EEO is. I think when many people think of civil rights, their immediate images are employees, workforce disparities, diversity, employment setting. And that's all essential. I mean, we support that, but our scope is totally different. For us, it's equal treatment of the entire population of the United States. It's the essence of providing top-notch customer service to all persons in government programs and activities, no matter what background people are. It's all about inclusion, having a big welcome mat to our programs. Just to give you a little anecdote, let's go back, 57 years now. I was on the earth. I don't remember this vividly, but we're going back to 1955. We're in Montgomery, Alabama. And one of our all-time civil rights heroes, Rosa Parks, faces one of the most famous arrests in the history of the United States, or the most infamous from the government standpoint. And let's look at what was she arrested for? Because she couldn't get a job? No, it was because of unequal access to public transportation. And that was the crux of the civil rights movements of the 1950s and 60s. Minorities could not get equal access to education or health or transportation or the criminal justice system. And employment was just one small part of the civil rights struggle. You know, so when we deal with the association and our agencies, we deal with the full range of government programs. And just an aside, you know, if you look at, it's more than just the law. There's a strong moral underpinning to this. When you look at the success of the civil rights movement, you know, you had people with strong faith. And I think that's no accident that this was successful. And I think it drives those of us in the profession right now, you know, by the fact that it's the law, but it's also the right thing to do.
Before we get into the law, I think it's worth emphasizing, because so much when we been in the community for a while, you know, we were talking about, you know, EEO programs, EEO diversity and things like that, you tend to really, as you said, think about employment and fair employment, you know, in the workforce, not only the federal workforce, but all the workforces. So I think it's important to emphasize, you know, there's a whole nother arm out there talking about, you know, public and equal access. And, you know, as you talked about the Rosa Parks situation, you go back to, you know, what was the heart of the civil rights movement then? You know, it wasn't yet about employment. You know, it was about public and equal access. I wonder for our listeners if you could lay the foundation of the law actually here. You know, I'm a lawyer. We could talk a little bit about the law. People tend to think everything EEO is Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, but that's not the whole story.
Right. The foundational law, of course, is the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That is the foundation. And Title VI covers race, color, and national origin in federal assistance programs. Then we have Title IX, which covers sex and educational programs, also in federal assistance. Then we deal with a range of disability rights laws, the Rehabilitation Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Architectural Barriers Act, and that covers equal access for people with disabilities. And then you add the Age Discrimination Act, and those are the most basic laws. And then you have other laws, other regulations, but those are the foundation, I think. And public a civil rights jurisdiction is established for all government programs and activities, and whenever there is federal financial assistance, you know, and that's billions and billions of dollars to state, local governments, sub-recipients, And let me just add that public civil rights is not a big bureaucratic burden on anybody. The equal access laws do not contain onerous paperwork provisions. They're assurances, they're public notification, they're mild demographic data maintenance requirements, but there are no racial quotas, no goals, no timetables. The focus is on policies and behaviors that promote inclusion. You know, we want to make sure that everyone is welcome to all programs and activities, that there's equal access, and that's what we all passionately believe in, and that's what we're determined to carry out all across the United States.
Again, I wonder if you could explain for our listeners, because, again, not everybody is as familiar with this component, with the public and equal access civil rights program component, as they are, say, with the other areas of the EEO arena that we've already talked about. I wonder if you can sort of explain how enforcement is done through the federal government, how guidance is provided. Does every federal agency have an office that deals with these external civil rights programs? Is there one specific office that does the enforcement? I wonder if you can give us a little background there.
Sure. The Department of Justice is the main oversight agency. There are others like the U.S. Access Board, but DOJ, gives us our overall guidance. And to enforce, there's a couple ways we do it. We respond to complaints from the public. And if we see a preponderance of evidence of unequal access, then we'll try to get corrective actions to correct that. If we can't get voluntary compliance, we can take enforcement action, which includes referring the case back to Department of Justice for civil enforcement through the courts or through a process of cutting off federal financial assistance. We also enforce equal access through systemic reviews of recipients of federal financial assistance. But increasingly, we emphasize proactive early intervention and prevention. As an example, we're trying to do a better job reaching out to multi-ethnic women's and disability community organizations and get their input right from the beginning. The more we talk to the communities and listen and respond, the less chance we will have of receiving a complaints down the road and have to take remedial action after the fact. So in conflict situations, we also try to emphasize mediation, we don't have to do the long investigation. We try to resolve it early.
And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, I know a few years ago with the Supreme Court decision in Alexander versus Sandoval, the sort of role of the public civil rights programs became more important, because previously to that decision, individuals who felt that their Title VI rights were violated on what we call adverse impact cases, and what that means is where there is a race neutral program, gender neutral program, neutral program, but it has an adverse impact, right, affecting one group, yes, a particular way or the other. It used to be that individuals could bring civil rights violation charges, and in this case, the Supreme Court said no. They said individuals can no longer bring these disparate impact cases. So what does that mean for your programs and what you're doing?
That's absolutely huge. This case came about, I guess, about 10 years ago. And again, it's Alexander v. Sandoval, and it involving alleged disparities under Title VI in Alabama. And the issue was policies that had a disparate impact. It was driver's license. There was a constitutional amendment making English only, and the court found that private parties do not have the right under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act to bring a lawsuit alleging disparate impact. They can sue if they allege intentional discrimination, and this decision changed the direction of our program. And this is a long-standing precedent, a disparate impact going back to the early 70s, and look at previous court cases, including Cannon versus the University of Chicago and the Guardians case, seem to endorse the coverage of disparate impact of discrimination under the Civil Rights Act. And this is a neutral a policy which has an adverse impact. But now with the Sandoval decision, since private parties cannot bring legal actions, the federal agencies are the only people that can do it. So there's more responsibility for the federal agencies to make sure that people are not left out of these programs because of a neutral policy which has a disparate impact, on entire groups of people.
And I mean, we should point out that the key here, I think, in the Supreme Court's ruling, or I haven't read that case in a while, but it's that these disparate impact cases do not involve intentional discrimination.
That is correct.
It's something that's applied neutral and across the board. We're going to stop here and hear a word from our sponsor. When we return, we'll wrap up our discussion about external civil rights programs in the federal government. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym. And it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're entering our last segment of the show. If you have a question or comment for our guests, call us at toll-free 877-936-9333, or you can always email us a question at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Before we took our break, we were talking with Doug Gentile from the Fish and Wildlife Service about the federal external civil rights programs throughout the federal government and the important role that they play and some of the history of it. We went all the way back to the Rosa Parks situation and kind of the changes that have happened along the way. But I wonder if you can really give our listeners some, people tend to identify with real examples. If you can give them some real examples of programs and issues that you all deal with day to day.
Well, I'm going to give you a big example. Very recently, of course, there was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, which impacted many, many people, Vietnamese American communities, many minority fishers, oyster harvesters. There was environmental damage, and there was tremendous response by federal agencies, and our people went down there, our public civil rights people went down there, to make sure that everybody was I'm included in this outreach because, there's just so many needs, people losing their livelihoods, people with psychological issues because of damages. People cannot get out to the work sites, so we were there to assist these communities and to listen to these concerns. That's just one example. I'm just going to give you, a real life situation. There's a person with disability who needs to get to a courthouse, maybe for a civil situation, maybe a criminal case. Let's just say it's a civil case. The person's in a wheelchair and can't even get into the courtroom because there's steps. So how is the person supposed to have any kind of court access if you can't even get into the building? And that's a real kind of situation that happened. And that's just a good example of some of the issues we have to deal with. Another situation, imagine yourself, you're a Korean immigrant, you just come to the United States. Maybe you have extended family, maybe they're around, maybe they're in a different state, and you have a health problem, and you have an emergency, and you call 911. You have to go to the emergency room, and you get to the hospital, and no one understands you because you. I just got here. Yes, you're trying to learn English. No, you have not mastered it yet. People do not understand you. They don't know what your condition is. You can die right in that emergency room. These things happen. These are real-life cases. This is not a program. This is not just some fancy government program. These are life and death issues facing millions of Americans, and that's what you know, our practitioners have to deal with. You know, we have to respond to these concerns. Another example, a predominantly Hispanic school was built next to a site. They had just buried toxic waste. Didn't even tell people in the school. They didn't even know about it, okay? So later on, we find out that the cancer rates of these students are really high because, well, nobody said a word to, you know, about of this terrible situation. And if we saw, you know, on the news in upstate New York, you know, a lot of the students, a lot of these young girls have these uncontrollable tics. And, you know, I cried when I saw that. And it turned out that there was, you know, some kind of poison issue, you know, not far from the school. And these are types of issues which have impacted not only minority, you know, but low income. You know, in Appalachia, where people have been forced to endure these pollutants. You know, I mean, going back, you know, decades, and you know, and recent studies show that these disparities are still going on, where people of color groups and low income groups have to bear their more than their fair share of pollutants, which threaten their health and safety. If you go back to the 1980s in Warren County, North Carolina, there was a movement called environmental justice, and it's now become a major part of public civil rights because of the disparities to make sure, you know, that it's not there's no unequal distribution, you know, of some of these policies which could be damaging, whether it be pollutants in the water, land, air. You know, these are just some of the examples, you know, and just another one, you know, when you have emergency preparedness. There are people with disabilities, you know, who need to be connected with the first responders. We've had people die because they couldn't get out with what would be hurricanes, tornadoes, low-income people who were impacted by that, people of color groups, as you learned from Hurricane Katrina. You know, we've learned a lot of lessons from that, but we're still learning lessons because, you know, there are so many needs when these disasters come up that our public civil rights people need to be very much engaged with our first responders, with the leaders of our agencies to make sure, you know, that nobody's left behind in these type of threatening situations.
Doug, let me ask you, what do your offices do to create awareness? Because it's interesting, we talk about these natural, you know, these disasters, you know, these natural disasters, you know, that have happened, and you know, people, you know, that's not their first concern. Your first concern is yourself half the time, you know, because you're dealing, you know, right, with this disaster. And I hate to keep, you know, we keep going back and drawing an analogy to the employment arena and how the EEO laws, you know, apply there. If I hire, you know, an employee who's got hearing difficulties or is deaf, I know I got to get an interpreter for certain situations. I run, you know, some conferences for OmniGov training. I know when I have a speaker, you know, who happens to be in a wheelchair, I know I need to have a lift to get him or her, you know, up on the podium. And there's certain things we do because it's just, you know, it's just obvious. And we, you know, in today's government, are doing pretty good at that, at a lot of these, you know, fair employment roles. But in situations like this, where you're talking about these disasters, you know, that's not what people are thinking about first. And not even, you know, not even our first responders, I wouldn't think. So how do you create awareness that there are these issues out there?
Well, first of all, there's a bipartisan executive order 13347, which basically orders the federal agencies to be aware of these issues in emergency preparedness. And there's a working team led by the Department of Homeland Security, which coordinates these efforts. I think every federal agency is part of that. FEMA is very active in that. And You know, and there's been education over years where they bring in the top managers and they have strategic plans to deal with this. So, you know, that the agencies are very much aware, you know, of the things that that they need to do, you know, to respond, you know, to make sure that no one's left behind, you know, in these types of emergencies, you know, and set the infrastructure in place with the state and local governments and the federal government all working in partnership, you know, to make sure that you know, everyone is getting equal treatment with regard to this major, major program of emergency preparedness and disaster response.
I wonder, in this sense, the question I'm about to ask, I think, you know, because we're drawing these analogies to the EEO employment arena and the public and equal access, there's always stereotypes, you know, that people feel, you know, these programs are, you know, they're only in place to deal with, you know, minorities, these groups that aren't me. You hear this a bunch when we try to promote diversity in the federal workforce. You know, people tend to think that means, you know, quotas, set asides, that you're making decisions based solely upon, you know, race, you know, national origin or gender. And those of us who know, that's not the case. It's about, you know, inclusion. It's about education.
Right. Yeah.
It's about creating awareness and knowledge that we're talking about. How do you deal with this issue in your world?
Thank you, Tony. We just need to constantly be vigilant about trying to dispel some of these stereotypes about our public civil rights program. Number one, it's not just a minority program. While minority groups have been discriminated against historically, these civil rights laws protect everyone from all backgrounds, including non-minorities. Now, for a lot of agencies the association deals with, a majority of the complainants are from non-minorities. You know, they may have a disability issue that they're raising. We get a lot of those types of cases, age or gender discrimination issues from non-minorities. Secondly, contrary to what some people insinuate, public civil rights officers are not a politically or ideological monolithic group. We have people from different political parties, including independents. Our association members and public civil rights officers have different beliefs on other issues and are all over the so-called political spectrum. The only thing that unites us is that we have a strong dedication to equal access and equal rights for everyone. We are career civil servants spanning presidential administrations. And if you look at some of the key civil rights legislation, it was passed historically in both Republican and Democratic administrations.
We spent the bulk of today talking about public and equal access programs, you know, what those roles and responsibilities are. I wonder if you could just take a minute or so and talk, you know, a little bit more about your association, the Federal External Civil Rights Specialists and Officers. I know you say you don't have an acronym. You see, you don't have an acronym yet. You'll get one sooner or later. You'll get one. You keep doing these shows. But I wonder if you can tell our listeners a little bit about the association, how they can get involved, and stuff like that.
We meet the third Tuesday of every month at 10 o'clock, usually at the USDA. You know, they've been very good about providing a space. Anybody with any public civil rights duties, even part-time, can come, you know, or people, you know, who just are interested can come. You know, there are security issues. If you're a federal employee, you have to, you know, go through security, and even if you are a federal employee, you have to show ID, you know, and we interact with some high-level officials, you know, and we have information exchanges. We have we cover the whole range of topics, and we try to educate our members, and we talk about language access, environmental justice, disability access, Title VI, emergency preparedness. And we bring in experts to talk about these things, and we have a lot of new people that come in the program all the time, and they come in, you know, and we pretty much try to get them up to speed on the program, and they really appreciate, you know, some of the training we give. It's not as comprehensive as Department of Justice, but, you know, it's very valuable, you know, because, you know, we have access to all the practitioners, so we bring them in, and it's just a real delight, you know, being part of this, because, you know— all our members are just so dedicated, and I keep learning more and more. Even though I've been in the program since the 1970s, I learn so much, just by going to association meetings and basically just interacting with people. So, yeah.
So Doug, believe it or not, that's all the time we have. If somebody wants more information, they can call you. What's your number?
Okay, yeah. It's 703-358-2558. Email Doug, D-O-U-G underscore Gentile, G-E-N-T-I-L-E, at FWS, as in Fish and Wildlife Service, .gov.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Thank you for joining us. A reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Have a great weekend.